Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsessions
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
Happy New Year! Hi, I'm Jackie Cation. You're listening to the Dork Forest. It is available on all of the websites, and including iTunes and Stitcher and YouTube. And if you go to dorkforest.com or jackiecation.com, you'll find links to all of it. And then I have another podcast with Lori Kilmartin just about stand-up comedy. But this is the Dork Forest, and it's January 2020, so Happy New Year, and feel free to start donating again. That's right. Donations went off last year, and I don't blame you, but think of me. And PayPal will let you do it monthly if you want, but I understand if you don't want, because monthly is its own commitment. But the people who do it monthly, I said do-do. I totally appreciate that. But there is also going to be new merch. I'm phasing out one of the Dork Forest t-shirts. I think it's the black one. It might be the green one. The green one's almost completely out of stock, so I think it might be the Dork Forest one itself, but feel free to try and order stuff so that I can get those two new shirts on the website, because right now the merch page is a bit crowded, shall we say. By the way, my website is done by Vilmos. You know that. The song that was just sang was composed by Mike Rickberg. He'll sing his version of the Mexican Hat Dance at the end of the program, and Patrick Brady is going to fix this audio and has been doing it for lo these many years, and I genuinely appreciate that about him so much. The new shirts are going to be a shirt with a bunch of my dad's sayings and a drawing of his face on that Jenny Fine did. And Jenny Fine, of course, was the artist who did the Meat Shield t-shirt, and she also did the art for the Horcrux album and DVD. You can get all of my old merch still at JackieCation.com, and the new merch, feel free to email me, Jackie@JackieCation.com, and we'll figure it out, is what I'm saying. I'm going to record a new album in 2020, but I don't know where or when. Feel free to come and watch me work on the new hour at JackieCation.com. Has all of my tour dates, and at JackieCation on Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat. There's also a Dork Forest Ranger page that you can get into. Donations, PayPal, Venmo, do whatever you need to do. But I'm very appreciative of everybody's support over the last 13 years. Let's get into some dorkdoms, shall we? Hey, it's Jackie Cation. I'm back in my living room, and I am with you. We haven't been on the show since the phoning days,
yes.
So it's probably been 11 or 12 years.
Wow.
Sean Conroy, ladies and gentlemen.
Hello.
Sean Conroy. Spelled Scene.
I read Scene, yes.
Scene Conroy. When I was a little girl, I read a dog book, and the dog's name was Sean, and I said Scene.
Which is what every teacher called me for the first 7 or 8 years of school, because there was... Sean was not a common name at that time.
Right.
So I would start school, and they would go, Scene Conroy, and I would go, it's Sean.
It's,
and of course, the other thing is, Sean Conroy is so close to Sean Connery.
Yes.
And people would...
You are a weapon. You are
They would mispronounce it all the time.
Weapon.
I actually said to my mom once, I said, why did you name me something so close to
Sean Connery?
This movie star?
Yeah.
And she said, we never thought he would be that famous. And I looked it up on Google.
Yeah.
And when I was born, he was doing his 6th James Bond movie. I mean, arguably the biggest franchise movie star in the world at that time. So,
Mom.
Yeah, exactly.
It's so Irish descent.
Yes.
Thanks for playing.
A little Scottish, but
okay.
Mostly Irish.
Sure. It's at Sean Sean Conroy Conroy
right.
On the Instagram and
Twitter.
Twitter.
Yes,
that's great. And you are literally, I have said this more than once, the only good improv I've ever seen. It is not okay, because it just means I need to see more improv, because
uh-huh.
It doesn't mean that you are not wonderful. It means that I haven't seen enough improv.
Yes.
Because your
there
dorkdom...
There are other good people.
Right. It turns out your dorkdom is improv.
Yes. That's what we're going to talk about.
I took a UCB class on improv.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I took the first level. I might have taken the second level as well.
Recently?
Probably in the last 6 years.
Holy shit.
And just because I... You know, stand-up is so pissy about improv. And
it's gotten a little better, but yes, for a long time, it was like, fuck those guys.
Fuck those guys who support each other. Yeah, and we got to watch them think on stage.
I fly solo, baby.
Right. There was a lot of judgment. And I was not really a huge
By the way,
it.
Judgment goes both ways, because I would be teaching classes 15 or 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And somebody would come in and I would be like, oh, that guy's a stand-up.
You know, like, right, right. It was, there was this weird, but it was, I don't know if that was in reaction to how much vitriol the improv, because I don't even know when improv started. Do you know when improv started?
I feel like I don't know,
okay.
But I want to say it was in, I want to say it was in the 50s.
The hippie totally, 50s and 60s?
I could be totally wrong about that, but I feel like there were things in the works around that time. It was supposed to be, I feel like it started mostly in Chicago. It was supposed to be theater for the people that addressed topics that the people were interested in, not the highfalutin playwright bullshit.
Oh, it was supposed to be more. So it wasn't created as...
It was for the hoi polloi.
Yes. And it wasn't created as a learning tool?
There might be some of that, too. I mean, I know Viola Spolin came up with all these games.
Who is that?
She's sort of the grand dame of improv.
Viola
Spolin.
Which is a great name.
Yes,
how do you spell Spolin?
S-P-O-L-I-N.
Okay.
And
why
I believe,
not?
If I'm not mistaken, I mean, I know her son, whose name I don't remember, maybe Paul Sills, also became a big influential figure and taught a bunch of people.
Right.
The person who I've heard the most about, because I'm affiliated with UCB.
Right.
Is Del Close.
Oh, yeah, I've heard that name.
Who was involved with all of that in Chicago at the time.
As well. So it kind of, it feels super Chicago-based?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. And then it sort of branched out to St. Louis and to Paris, France. No, I don't know.
Probably New York, Los Angeles.
I don't know that there was ever a big improv scene in New York. Like, I was in a group in New York starting in the early 90s that had come from Chicago to New York in the early 80s.
Oh, okay.
And
Is Second City improv?
Yes.
Okay.
Or at least they started as an improv company. And
right,
now,
and now it's sketch,
their
right?
Their big show is a sketch show, yes.
And sketches are pre-written, just for the American public or anybody listening who might not know. But they're
sketch is what they do on Saturday Night Live. They write it ahead of time. They either memorize their lines, or as they do on SNL, they write them on a pasteboard and hold them up in front of their faces and read them that way.
Oh, during the show, they don't have to memorize the script?
I mean, if you watch SNL, you can see everybody reading their lines.
You know, I've never watched SNL. I've seen only clips.
Really?
Yeah. It's sketch comedy, or skits, as no one should ever call them.
Yeah. That is a thing, like, where somebody goes, oh, so you do skits, and you're just like, a shudder runs down my spine.
Right. For some reason, it is a visceral reaction to the word skit.
It just feels like something you would do in the Cub Scouts, you know?
Right, right. It's a
R.I.P., I guess, now that they've declared, that the Boy Scouts have declared bankruptcy.
Oh, no, they're good. They'll be back. And
sure, the Catholic Church hasn't gone away.
Exactly. None of the, it's such a, you would think that adult men would care more about little boys than they do, but they don't, it turns out.
Except in the wrong way.
Exactly. You're just like, we lived through it.
Yeah.
Just fucking suck it up.
Yeah.
Walk it off. Anyway, but the, so there's Viola Spolin and Del Close.
Del Close.
Are there other famous?
So Del Close in Chicago is the guy who was responsible for starting Improv Olympic, which then is where the people who founded UCB came from.
Oh, okay. And the people who founded UCB were Chicago improvers?
All Chicago people, yeah.
Okay. And who founded Matt Besser?
So UCB was Matt Besser, Ian Roberts, Matt Walsh, and Amy Poehler.
Okay. So, and Tina Fey came out of Second City.
Right.
Okay.
So Matt and Ian and Amy were... I don't know if all of them did Second City. I think three of the four of them maybe did Second City.
Right.
There were a bunch of different improv companies in Chicago.
And there was some overlap.
Right.
Okay.
But they, so the four of them got together and started doing sketch together.
Yeah.
And decided that they needed to go make it big in a first city, not in the second city. So either they had to decide to go to New York or Los Angeles. So they moved to New York. They started performing in New York, doing sketch. They also started doing their show, ASCAT, which was their improv show.
Oh, and they invented that. Because ASCAT is, I have done that. That's the one where you tell a story and then people, the improvers, perform improv from that story.
The improvers do skits off that story.
I'm going to be saying the wrong words. But they, yeah. The, so that's.
The improvisers perform.
The improvisers perform. Yes. And so, yeah. Okay. So that's. That's what I saw. Here's what happened. Okay. I took a UCB class.
Right.
And part of that class was you had to go see a lot.
Oh, yeah. They always want you to go see
shows.
A couple shows.
Yeah. And so I ended up watching you and Matt Besser do long form improv.
Right.
And it was fascinating to me because I had, back in the 80s when I first started doing stand up.
Right.
So this is 84. We would. There were a bunch of comics that came through for the, in this comedy club that I started at in Madison, Wisconsin, owned by Bill Kinison, Sam Kinison's brother.
Okay.
We would end the they wanted all the comics who came from LA wanted to end every show with improv.
But it was not long form.
It was dumb.
It was short form.
It was short form. Mm-hmm. It was genuinely relatively painful. It was freeze tag and this thing called 185
something walked into a bar.
Right.
Yes.
Right. And so it was literally an excuse for puns.
Cleverness, puns, who's
Dick
the smartest.
Jokes.
Yeah.
It was a riff contest is more than anything.
Right.
And it was usually filthy. And so that was my introduction to improv. And then, so when I took this class, 30 years later, right? And it was long form. One of the things that the teacher tried to impress upon us that I didn't really get until I saw you and Matt Besser is that you have to be comfortable on stage so that you show your own personality. Mm-hmm. There was no time when I thought you two had been doing it for so long, I felt like, that I felt the safest I've ever felt in an improvisation.
It is gut-wrenching when you don't feel safe in an improv show. It's like, oh my God. Which I think is what, to some people, is the attraction.
Okay.
It's the same reason people go and watch diving competitions, because somebody might hit their head.
Right, right. Know? Or race car.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, there might be a crash.
Right. But I don't, but you guys, so it was this long form thing and the suggestion would come, for a topic. And then there would be a beat where one or the other of you would take a moment and I could see you thinking and you're like, okay. And you would do a thing that I do in stand up, which is I take things from my life.
Mm-hmm.
And then you created a scene from something in your life. At no time did I feel like you were going to be like exceptionally crass just for the shock jock value,
right?
Or racist or horrible. And it was
no, I keep my racism off stage.
Is that keep that off key? Mm-hmm. And well played. And it was just because sometimes in the class that I took, it was like early stand up where people are just throwing things at the wall.
They're frantic.
They're frantic.
Yeah.
That and that friend.
Because if I don't get the laugh now, I might never get a laugh. I might never get a laugh again, you know?
Right. Right. And that feels like a learned skill to learn to slow down.
Well, here's another thing you just said, which I really think is interesting. So I did short form for years.
Okay.
Before I ever did long form. And just so people know what short form is.
Please.
Short form is what you would see on Whose Line Is It Anyway, where throughout the show, you constantly take suggestions from the audience and you have to use those suggestions in
your
scene. No, in other words, we'll start a scene and I'll say, okay, I need a profession and I need a country of origin and I need a thing two people might argue about.
Right.
And then I do a scene where I am a French pilot arguing with someone about interest rates.
Right, okay.
You know, so I've gotten all three of those suggestions from the audience, and I am trying to fulfill those suggestions.
Right.
And I did that for years. I did it with a group in New York. I traveled all over the country performing with them.
And is that kind of... So that was your entry level to improv.
That was how I started, yes.
Okay.
Then I went... I heard about this group, the Upright Citizens Brigade. I went to see them do their sketch show. I went to see them do their skits.
Right.
And... and I liked it. It didn't blow my mind. I was like, oh, you know, they're funny. They're funny. Yeah. I've seen other funny things. This was also a funny thing.
This is another funny thing.
And then I went to see their improv show. And because I had been doing improv for 8 years up till that point, and I knew what improv was, or at least I thought I did, when I went to see ASCAT, it was like, holy fucking shit. You can do that? That's what I want to do.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I don't know what a good analogy is. I always like to use basketball analogies, but it's like, imagine if you were 7 feet tall and you played basketball your whole life and you never knew you could dunk.
Right.
And then you saw somebody do it and you're like, wait a second, you can do that?
Right.
And so what I loved about it, which is what you said, is that in long form, you take one suggestion and then that inspires everything to come from inside you. So you're not responding to external stimuli. You are bringing your own life experiences into the work you're doing on stage.
Okay.
And it just, to me, was a whole other level of interest and fun and enjoyment.
It was so interesting. That's what I genuinely think that that's what made me aware that it could be done. It was not as big of a revelation to me, just because I think that that coming as you did from those 8 years of doing it, when you see someone doing what you think you're doing,
right,
and then at another level,
it was like, I know what improv is.
Right.
This is not what I know what it is. What is this?
Right.
You know?
But they're calling it the same thing, which means that I too could do that.
Right.
I think it's sort of like genuinely, and this it's going to sound like a little smoke blowing, but the first time I saw Dana Gould do stand-up was I was like, what is he doing? Because it was so personal and so filthy and and very, very hilarious. It was both incredibly personal, smart filth, and hilarious, which I think I was like, oh, that can be done. And he didn't, it didn't feel like he cared that it was that filthy.
Right.
It was like the thing of those three beats that he found
there was
most,
a reason it was that filthy.
Right.
I feel like that's where people who do improv fall down. I have no problem. I mean, I'm a very uptight Irish Catholic, as we already discussed. So I don't like to talk about those things in real life, and that's not my go-to material.
Right.
But I have no problem going way down in the muck if it's what the scene calls for and being as dirty as possible. I think what happens in improv a lot is people go, again, what we were talking about before is like frantic and panic is like, I just have to mention bodily function so I can get a laugh. People will laugh if I just say something dirty.
Right.
And it's completely unearned. So that was always my note when I was teaching classes was like, go blue, but only go blue if you've done the work to get there.
Right, right.
You know?
Much like when I was taking clarinet lessons when I was 8 years old, I liked Benny Goodman, and he got to hold it up right. And my Mr. Owie, my clarinet teacher said, when you can play as good as Mr. Benny Goodman,
then
you can hold it however you want. Until then, we're going to learn like
this
Picasso.
This is the way we do it. Yeah.
We're going to learn how to draw right, and then you're going to get to do whatever you want.
Yeah.
So that sort of personal space that personal experience, because that makes all theater more interesting anywhere, all performances more interesting, and really fascinating in the case of improv because it is happening in the moment.
Right.
Right.
And I also feel like, this is a little scary to me sometimes, so I try not to think about it. You know, when I'm doing shows, I am being characters or, you know, reacting to what somebody else is saying and whatever. But I also am bringing my own experiences and my own attitudes and my own whatever. And I feel like if you watched a good improviser, which I consider myself a good improviser.
Sure.
If you watch a good improviser do five shows, you know everything about that person. Like, they're bearing their soul if they're really good.
Well, and that's, I mean, I agree in the fact that if you're watching good performance of several different kinds, I mean, mm-hmm. it can be, I remember I saw Moulin Rouge, the movie, and Nicole Kidman, and I had not seen her a lot before, or she, I don't, I'm sometimes inattentive, not a huge surprise to Rangers of the Dark Forest, well played, but, I remember watching it, and I was watching her act, Nicole Kidman in Moulin Rouge, and I said, I bet she is kind of like that, just kind of an opportunist, but who's a decent person inside. You just have to get to it. And I was like, is she acting, or is she finding that part of her in her to perform that part?
Right.
You know? And it's a weird analogy just because it's such an old movie. But I
saw the movie, and I had just started dating a girl, and mm-hmm. she was like, let's go see this movie. And I did not enjoy the movie. I don't really remember it.
Yeah.
Because I was like, can't we just go home and fuck? Now, that was Blue. Did I earn that or not?
Or was that just you riffing?
Was it
off
me
of something
just
real?
Panic fire. I got to get a laugh
gotta
off
get
the
a
fuck.
Just throw you some know? Shit at the wall. It's, yeah, I think that, yeah, it does. It is cool. This is the other thing, though, is are there fakers? Are you watching anybody fake improv? Is it almost impossible to do?
No. I don't think it's impossible. I think there are people who are... I think the way I approach it is a very writerly skill. So it's... I mean, I guess what I'm getting at is there are some people who are just like showmen. And
right.
so... they're just going to go out and be as big and loud and wild and weird as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And it works for them because of who they are.
Right. So it's actually coming from them.
Yeah. So I guess that's not faking it, but it's also not like they'll do the same things over and over again as opposed to because they know it works as opposed to really being in the moment and reacting to what's going on in the scene.
Is that what you love about it? Is that, do you spend, are you good at that off stage being in the moment?
No, absolutely not.
Right. I mean,
no, I always say to people, to me, the thing I love about improv, and I think I said this to you in the email that I sent you, but it's like, improv is the very definition of a hobby. You will never make money as an improviser and certainly never make a living, but I've been doing it nonstop for over 30 years now.
Right.
And what I love about it is that it is the one time and the one place that I can shut my crazy brain off and just be. It's like a meditation for me. It's like almost a Zen. I don't even know what Zen is, so I don't know why I say that. But it's like I'm not questioning myself. I'm not, you know. Yeah, exactly. The pop culture version
of Zen. But I swear to God, I could see that in your performance. And when I see someone who is very much in that, because my stand-up is a little manic, and but there's underneath it is this, I'm like, I have these jokes. I have to try these 17 lines, right?
Right. So stand-up is different in that way to me, where it's more, when I do stand-up, I would love to move further towards being in the moment as a stand-up.
Yeah.
But I'm always like, oh, I have these two new things I want to try. It's like I have two different brains going on at the same time.
Right. Well, I think that it's almost like different kinds of this is getting very meta, but it feels like different kinds of meditation, right? There's the meditation where you are in the moment and you have shut off the other part of your brain and you're just feeling.
Right.
And you're feeling and you're expressing that feeling. In stand-up, it's the zen of, this is a bad analogy maybe, but a white noise where I am so in one of those sensory deprivation tents working on the bit that the audience, I see them.
Right.
I feel the laughter. I feel the responses on like a molecular level.
That one guy is not really paying attention.
Oh, God, that guy. That fucking dude, man. Anyway, but and there was, and I'm doing some racial stuff right now. And so I'm like, look, there's a person of color. There's a person of color.
Right, right.
Make sure I'm not staring at the one person of color too much.
Right.
So that they don't think that they are obligated to laugh more or anything. Because to some extent, I'm trying to, the part of this bit is me schooling white people to fucking not do the thing that I'm trying not to do right now. And so like, there's this whole project, in my, but I'm in the middle of it. Which feels like meditation too, where the rest of the world is busy and I'm juggling, but I'm juggling like an actual juggler who can juggle a bunch of things at one time.
I could do three, but that's it.
I can't do any. I can barely catch. So, but yeah, I love the side of it. So, you did 8 years of short form,
right?
On the road.
On the road.
With a troupe.
Yes.
Were they corporates? Were they schools?
Well, some of them were corporate. A lot of them were colleges.
Okay.
A lot of them, honestly, were JCCs all over the country.
Sure.
The Jews love their short form improv.
And they're super supportive.
Yes.
Well, they love clever wit.
Right.
And so good for
them. There was a short form we did where an improviser would leave the room and you had to get a suggestion from the audience of a phrase, and then the person had to come back into the room and guess the phrase based on clues provided by the other improvisers. It was called Torture the Actor. And I remember once we were doing a JCC out in the Midwest somewhere, and the phrase that somebody gave us, of course, was gay cock afinyan, which is Yiddish and means go shit in the ocean. And
first of all, that is awesome that you can recall all of those things. Go.
But so the person came back in and it was just this thing where these Jewish people in the Midwest could not believe that somebody was able to guess that they had said gay. Now, there was never a doubt in our minds that somebody was going to get the phrase. Like, it just always, they always got the phrase.
Oh, did they always get the phrase?
Always, 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 because you would just keep going until they got the phrase. Oh. Sometimes it was 4 or 5 hours.
Which is why they shoot that show with Proops forever.
Right, right.
And,
but they were just, to them, for these...
It was like magic.
Northeastern, I forget even who it was, but it was somebody who was not Jewish, and they were like, oh my God, that guy got gay cock afinyan, and it was the funniest thing they had ever seen.
And did it, I mean, the thing is how are you supposed to do that?
I'm probably saying that completely wrong, by the way.
But the thing is we talk about going blue and being dirty. If it's got gay cock in it, you have all of a sudden performing
you gotta do it. Yeah.
Right. You're like,
you got to give that clue.
We didn't come up with the term.
Right.
You did. Here we go.
And the audience is always on board for that.
Right.
With those things.
You know? I'm sure that whoever suggested it was just like, get it? I'm a genius.
Well, that's one of the things I always hated about short form was the people who were so proud of their suggestions, you know? Like, one of the first times I ever performed, I don't know why, you know, you look back and you're like, what the fuck was I thinking? But I had, like, friends and family in the audience.
Ah.
And one of my friends, who had been one of my roommates in college, what had been a student at the high school my father was the principal of. So my father knew this guy.
Right.
I had lived with him. He came to the show. And
your father was also there?
My father was also there.
What a shit show.
Somebody said, well, it literally a shit show because somebody, you know, we said, can we get a suggestion of a profession? And this guy was like, proctologist. Like that was the funny suggestion.
How many times have you gotten that suggestion?
I mean, yeah, exactly.
How many stars are in the sky? How many grains of sand?
It happens in long form, but you only have to get one suggestion. Like, I can remember a show I did with the improv group I was eventually placed in New York, and that I've been working with now for 20 years.
Who places you? What is happening?
Well,
I don't know
what the program is like now. There's like a committee involved in deciding who gets to be on which team, and then they sort of evaluate the team after 6 months and whatever. But when I was coming up, it was a much smaller program. It was not the huge industrial industrial complex had not started yet.
Right.
It was still the mom and pop improv show.
Right.
But basically what happened was Amy Poehler said, I want to direct a show. You two guys, and it was two guys that I know, mm-hmm. I want you two guys to be in the show. You each get to pick a couple of people to be on this team.
Okay.
What I didn't learn until many years later is that these two guys picked, you know, one of them picked these two people, the other one picked these two people, Amy put somebody else on the team, and then they were like, Amy was like, we need one more strong player, and that was how I got on the team. So I was the last, I was the one still on the fence when
you were picked last?
I was picked last, yeah.
The thing is in that situation, though, you're just like, I'll be picked last.
Yeah. Right. But I can remember doing a show with them once, because we did a show at Friday nights at 10 o'clock for 5 years in New York, and it was just one of the greatest artistic experiences of my life.
That's so cool.
Every moment of it. But one night we were starting a show, and I said, can we have a suggestion? And a row of people stood up and shouted, Dildo Factory.
Oh my God.
Because they had, you know, been out to dinner on Friday night and decided, let's fuck with these people.
Right, we had a bottle of wine. We're doing this.
And so the first scene began with somebody very carefully painting veins on a, on a dildo.
See, I think the response where you're just like, watch me turn this
into
Waiting for Godot.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. Like, and that's what I love about long form is that it comes from us. It's not it could be anything. It could be Dildo Factory, and we're still going to make it into an artful exploration of real human relationships, you know? We're not going to be like, this is why Dildo Factories are funny. Yeah,
right. And that's the whole thing, is that at no time when I was also watching you and Matt, did I think that you had any doubt that it would be funny.
Mm-hmm.
And that you were literally going for the interesting, that you knew the funny would then come from it.
Well, to go back to my favorite topic, Dildo Factory, like, immediately in that scene, this guy's painting a vein on a dildo, and you're like, oh, this is not a scene about how funny it is to be a dildo factory. This is about a guy who takes pride in the detail of his work. That's what this scene is about, you know?
Do you know, why doesn't Jim Wooster, I have a friend, one of my very best friends from Minneapolis, stand-up comic, hasn't been done stand-up in probably a handful of years. He's always been a writer, right? And he writes short fiction, and he writes plays and scripts. But when he did stand up, some of his premises were that. I mean, he literally was talking about the desperation of a factory worker at one point. The hilarity in this stand up bit was about a guy. He was like, who do you feel
His stand-up, by the way, led directly to the current presidential administration.
Exactly. All I remember about this bit was it about a man who knew exactly how to make tar waffles. And he had a waffle iron.
I don't even know
iron.
What that is.
Right. It was a waffle iron. And it was a man who would take a ladle and dip in and pour the exact right amount into the tar waffle to create a tar waffle. And he was like, The new guy who comes in is like, why are we fucking making tar waffles? And yet the beauty of the guy who knew exactly how to do it had been doing it for 30 years.
Uh-huh.
And it was this weird ass picture of humanity.
Yeah.
And that's Jim Wooster's stand-up act, which is why I think He didn't work a lot. Because he also had this analogy.
But he can make the fuck out of a tar waffle.
He could make the fuck out of a tar waffle. He had this analogy about the end of the world that ended with a post-it note of like a tumbleweed in the desert that just said, call Steve. And that's why the Armageddon happened. And you're like, oh, shit. Anyway, but it's there's so much. I mean, 5 years of doing a show at 10 o'clock on a Friday night, you must have seen so many sort of amazing moments.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, now it all blurs together and I don't remember any of them.
And it's so, it's in the moment. Like these are not things that you ever repeat, right?
Right. And that is a thing that to me got to be very frustrating after I had been doing ASCAT here in Los Angeles for a couple years, when I was, you know, I had my first sitcom writing job. I had like done little parts that I call weird guy on different sitcoms, you know.
Sure.
You just have one guy who dips in for one line at the end of a scene just to give you the blackout. Like,
right.
I'll go home with you. I had done like a bunch of those. But
so flattering casting. Yeah. Casting. There's nothing more flattering.
But I was like, I'm doing these amazing shows every week and nobody cares. And I started to call it throwing diamonds in the ocean.
Yeah.
Like, we have these amazing things and we're throwing them away. And eventually what I realized is that's the beauty of it, is that it is a thing that exists in that moment for that audience and will never be seen again. And you can't even, I mean, it's always funny when people try to explain what they saw in an improv show because there's no way to follow it. You're like, I don't understand
right. What
the connection is between these things. If you're there,
right. You
get it.
Yeah.
But if you're not there, it happens so quickly and in so non-sequentially
right. That
it's impossible to explain to somebody what was funny about it.
Here's does it happen and is it common or is it does it not happen that you can write a script or a story or a play from something that came from an improv?
I don't.
Have you seen it?
I don't find myself doing that. I think people do that. In fact, I think that's how Second City develops a lot of their sketch shows, is they take ideas and they sort of improvise them on stage and eventually start to set them. For me, what I find is more that I'll have an idea of something I want to write, and then the improv will help inform that writing process.
Okay.
You know?
Well, yeah, I suppose the muscle of coming up with things in the moment has got to help every writing thing that you've ever
done.
It's
like sitting down at a Smith Corona
okay.
Selectric typewriter.
Do you have one of those ribbons that has the whiteout?
Right.
That's great.
But like sitting down in front of a screen is a completely different thing from really reacting in the moment. So
yeah.
I will do that and I'll write a bunch of stuff and then I'll try to go through and read it out loud and honestly react in each moment to each thing and see if I can come up with more interesting stuff or interesting jokes or whatever. And that to me is where the improv really helps me.
That's interesting only because whenever I have to write something, I always read it out loud. Just because, in my opinion, whether you're writing nonfiction or like an article, you can hear, I'm not particularly good at grammar and punctuation.
Mm-hmm.
The grammar's okay. The punctuation is hard. I tend to use commas as breath marks. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but the... By the way,
I will tell you that nobody is good at grammar and punctuation.
Oh, really?
I am.
Right.
So it drives me fucking crazy.
Right. The handful of people that I know who are, I literally have paid them.
Right.
Could you just take it?
But like I was the head writer for this show on Adult Swim for years.
Which one?
It's called Mr. Pickles. And
you're wearing a Pickles crew.
I am. I'm wearing Mr. Pickles sweatshirt. But, you know, I would get scripts from writers and whatever, and I would just be like, fuck is this person thinking? This
right.
is an educated person.
Didn't
and
you
they
go to
did...
Purdue? What just
exactly.
happened?
Exactly. But it's so it does it so doesn't matter. But it's just like that's how my brain.
That's
is,
how your brain goes.
You know?
But that's why I read it out loud because I could hear I could hear the problems in the phrasing. Mm-hmm. If anytime I write anything, if I were to write a book, 400-page book, I would have to freaking read it out loud because it would drive me bananas.
Right.
To not know how it sounds. And
I mean, writing is, after all, just a representation of the spoken word.
Right.
So it makes sense that it's easier to say it out loud and go, oh, that doesn't work. Let me change that.
Right. But I think it's interesting that you use it also as a writing tool, because I just I'll come up with, well, that sentence doesn't work. And then I'll just usually put a bracket on it and like fix that later. But you in the moment are got a blank piece of paper and you're writing down notes of what you're riffing off of your own writing, which I think is fascinating. Good work.
What? Thank you. That's why I have such a huge
career. We haven't mentioned the fact that you have a new podcast.
That's true.
That I'm talking to Sean Conroy, by the way, and it's SeanConrow. R-O-W. What just happened there?
Sean
R-O-Y.
Cornrow. I used to teach junior high school, and that was an insult the kids would use on me sometimes, was they would call me Mr.
You know what?
Mr. Cornrow. Mr. Cornrow. And I would be like, oh,
Conroy. Come on,
you can do better than that.
Keep writing. And so it's called Get Happier?
Sean Conroy Gets Happier.
Sean Conroy.
It's not
gets
about
happier.
You getting happier.
Oh,
it's about me getting happier.
Yeah, yeah. Tune in.
And hopefully
it bleeds
me
over.
Getting happier will benefit you in some way.
Right. And it's are there any apps?
And by the way, it's not get happy, gets happy.
Oh.
It's happy. Gets happier.
Interesting.
Even an incremental change can make a difference.
Right. And you had the long shot for a long time.
Yes, we did the long shot for 10 years.
Right. And so people, and I've been on it a couple of times, mm-hmm. so you guys, if you remember that, you should listen to Sean Conroy's.
Yeah.
Sean Conroy Gets Happier.
Yes.
And are there any episodes out, or is it all just going to start dropping?
It's going to start, I hope, and I think, March 2nd.
March 2nd, okay.
Is when the first
this
episode
comes
and
out
the
March
second episode.
March 10th.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, there should be episodes around already.
Excellent. Yes. Look into it. You know what to do. You're all podcast listeners.
Yes.
And, so I had a question. Could have been anything. Here we go. So there's, what's the scene like here in Los Angeles? How about that? What
do you love? In terms of?
Improv. Is it, because you are still working with the UCB.
Yeah. I still do Ask Cat every Saturday and Sunday.
Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah.
Huh.
Which is a lot. And it just, sometimes I'm like, why am I still doing these shows two nights a week?
Right.
It also, because I do stand up as well, although that's debatable at this point too.
Because there's not enough time in the day.
Yeah, and also because I was writing on this show for so long.
Yeah,
I would just be exhausted at the end of the day, and not
right. You have full like
be
a
able
whole
to go
life.
Out. Yeah,
yeah.
It's funny. I saw Lori Kilmartin on an airplane a couple years ago.
Right,
and I was just in the middle of like, you know, the show was stressing me out. I was fighting with the creators of the show and fighting with the network and fighting with the production company, and was so exhausted all the time from all that I was not doing stand-up. And Lori, as you know better than I do, is out doing stand-up all the time despite her full-time job and her motherhood and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Lori, how are you able to do this? She was flying to New York on a Friday night to do a comedy festival in New York, fly back on Sunday night, and go back to work at Conan on Monday morning.
Right.
And I was like, how do you do this? And she said, and it really rang true to me, although I have not acted on it yet. I'm still hoping to. She was like, stand-up is the only thing I do where I feel like I have total control over everything.
Yep.
Like, I can write a billion jokes in the morning. Maybe one or two of them get on the show that night.
Yep.
But when I do stand-up, I can do whatever I want.
Right. She has expressed that to me, too. It's such a great... It really sums up what she gets out of it, mm-hmm. right? And I think you get that out of doing those two improv shows.
Yes and no.
No?
Because one of the things you have to deal with when you're doing improv is the other people you're improvising with.
That is right. It is not a solo activity.
And I don't get to decide who I'm improvising with.
Oh, you don't?
Because I'm doing this UCB ASCAT show.
Right. But don't you, is it you and Matt every time?
No, Matt is rarely there at this
point. So it's rotating.
It's a rotating crew, and I don't know until the afternoon who's going to be there for the show that night.
Interesting.
And there's just some people I like working with more than other people.
Well,
you know?
Yeah, some there's just a you click better, and it just it ends up being.
And I'm sure there are many people who feel the same way about me.
Well, there's nothing to be done.
Oh shit! Look who's on the roster.
My favorite thing is when I'm like, "Oh, that guy doesn't like me," and then you find out they weren't thinking about you at all.
Right.
And you're like, "Oh,"
which is 99% of the time.
99% of the time, and you're like, "Well, that's also disappointing for some weird reason." And
I'm not important.
I'm not important enough for you to even to hate. Interesting. And I think I've said this before, is that what you put your attention on, right, is the thing you really want to do.
Right.
And like, I would love to act, and I say that, but do I act? Everyone I know who loves to act freaking acts.
Right.
Like, they're in community things, they start their own YouTube channel.
Right.
They do they write and they perform some sort of acting. They act all the time because they fucking love acting. I will go to an open mic because I need to do stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
And and I think you need to do improv.
I do, but I literally had a meeting with somebody about this yesterday. I mean, a meeting. We sat and had coffee and talked for 2 hours.
We get to
in
call
LA. We call
now.
That a meeting.
We get we get to get breakfast.
But were talking about stand up and about how, I mean, I'm frustrated with myself that I have not been doing it.
Right.
And I want to. I still really, really want to. And
do you live on this side of the hill, or do you live over
I
there?
I live in Hollywood.
Okay.
And I achieved a certain level of success.
Yeah.
But I don't think I've ever really gotten as good at stand-up as I could have gotten if I had really committed to it.
There's a Wednesday and a Saturday open mic that I would recommend.
Okay.
Dan Telfer.
I know who Dan
and
is.
Thea Lux.
I don't know that I...
And Thea Lux.
It's on this side?
Yeah, it's at essentially, it's a board game store. So
love
it's
it.
The it is a very much a version of Nerd Melt, except for that... It's called Geeky Teas, T-E-A-S, like, because they used to serve tea, and then they found out that you actually need a food license. So now they just sell tea, and they have a cooler with some sodas in it. And but Geeky Teas has a theater space, and then they also do Cat Rescue. So it's literally, you know how Nerd Melt was a comic book store, which is dorky enough, but it was also super cool.
Uh-huh.
Geeky Teas. Not super cool. Holy Great. Smokes. They're a bunch of board game nerds with some cats. Uh-huh. And then they have a theater in the back, which has an open mic on, I think, every Wednesday and Saturday. But they also have book shows there. And
I'm on it. No, because this
fun.
Is the plan I came up with yesterday. Yeah. Is I was like, I want to, starting in March, March 2nd, I want to do... 60 shows in 60 days and see how I feel after that.
Interesting.
Because it's...
might get happier.
I might get happier.
Right?
100%. 100%.
The prediction is, Swami predicts, 100% happier.
Yes.
From 100% of seven, of course.
But it's like, I want to figure out if this is what I really want to do. Like, I went on tour a couple years ago, just a self-booked thing for 2 months.
Oh, to all do over some stand-up? Yeah.
All over the country. I think I drove like 12,000 miles or something.
Wow.
And I fucking loved it. I had such a good time just going from town to town and doing stand-up. And not even like clubs or anything. Like a local improv theater or, you know, a local alternative night even at some places.
Right. The local, the thing is that is the joy of it.
Yeah.
To do the clubs is a job.
Right.
Where half the, literally three quarters of the damn job is getting the gig.
Yeah.
And then showing up and... But these, it's like what Kinane and Doug Stanhope and, you know, you're back before Doug Stanhope. I can't even think of anybody, but it was just, clubs aren't booking
Abbott and Costello.
Abbott and Costello, vaudeville,
right.
Everything. And Mark Twain. Mm-hmm. He used to book his own coffee shops back in the late 1800s. And so, but there's no money in it. right? Like, you can't really make a living.
Yeah, yeah, no, it was unsustainable. I mean, yeah. I think I broke even. I was always amazed at these little, like I remember doing, like, a brewing company in Birmingham, Alabama, in front of, you know, 80 or 100 people, and at the end of the night, the guy gave me $100, and I was not the only person he paid, and I was like, holy shit, outside of New York and L.A., you actually do get paid for these tiny little shows.
Right, right, right.
But that said,
$100 is not going
to
do anything.
No, I had to pay for the hotel. I had to pay for gas.
Yep.
I did stay with a lot of Long Shot podcast listeners along the way, which was always fun. Yeah. Although all of them had dogs, and I am allergic, so that was a problem, but, you know.
That's good that you're not allergic to cats, since I'm sending you to Geeky Tees.
No, so, I'm not. I have no problem with cats.
That's amazing. So what? So you're doing improv twice a week. What have you seen in the last 30 years about changes and about quality? And, like, are you blown away sometimes? By the noobs?
No. I'm not. But part of that is because I don't go see them.
Okay.
You know? I think that, I mean, this is what happens when you get old, is you go, it's not as good as it was when I started. But I think part of that is because I have seen so much and seen everything at this point.
Okay.
That it's very hard to be impressed by anything.
Right.
Whereas people who are young are seeing everything for the first time, and they're like, holy shit, that was amazing.
Right.
Now, all of this said,
yes,
I, for the first time in over 20 years, am taking an improv class right now.
Interesting.
Yes. Which is super weird. Because everybody in the class knows, yeah, and they also they all know who I am, and they know what I do and what I've done and whatever, and I try not to impose on them in any way or whatever. Right. But the class is a musical improv class. I've always been a big fan of musical theater.
Okay.
And back in the day when I was working with this short form group, one of the things we did was we would improvise musical stuff.
Okay.
And so,
and it was so much fun.
I loved it.
You're like, I want to take this class.
Yeah.
Is it through the UCB or?
Okay. It is. And so it's like, I think yesterday was our fifth class.
Of how many?
Of six.
Okay.
And we have three shows. We've done one so far. We have two more shows to go.
Yeah.
And it's funny because the show is at the same theater I do this other show at all the time. And so I was there last week and did the silly little class show.
Yeah.
And all the people in the lobby who are the people there for the other show I do were just kind of staring at me. Like, none of them knew what I was doing there. They were like, you're early for the show. And I'm like, no, I'm actually in this show.
Right.
And they were like, the class show? Yes, I'm taking the class.
Yeah, I'm trying to grow as a person. Yes. It's okay. You know that Maria's taken a lot of improv classes.
I did know that because I saw her in the cafe there one time.
Yeah, the Marie Bamford will take an intro. She took a stand-up class, too, from Judith Shelton.
Oh, really?
And she likes to take the classes because she finds that they – sometimes the perspective can get changed.
Yeah.
And she doesn't see a lot of stand-up comedy, and she likes to see what the
– the noobs.
The noobs are doing. And she's like, well, I can be – she's very inspirational in her inclusiveness and her willingness to – be entertained.
I say this much more to credit Maria than to credit myself, although I also feel like I am a little bit this.
Yeah.
To me, that shows, I mean, Maria's like one of the best stand-ups I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. It just shows such a level of humility and lack of ego to go,
that willingness,
I still
alone.
Have more to learn.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. It's just, there's so many comics, and I don't know if this happens in improv, that sort of sit on their laurels and don't grow and change.
I feel like, so when UCB came to town, which was 1996.
Okay.
I was still with this other company, and there were a lot of really talented people in this short form company.
Right.
Who came to see UCB, and, you know, they were like, oh, this is different from whatever. But I'm not taking a fucking class. I don't take classes.
Right.
And those people are no longer doing it.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I was like, I love this. I want to do what those guys are doing. I want to do this ASCAT show. Mm-hmm. I mean, the people I was seeing in ASCAT at that time were the UCB, Adam McKay.
Right.
Stephen Colbert.
Wow.
Tina Fey. You know what I mean? Like
Jesus.
Yeah.
It was like
Jesus.
It was just like the Pope was there. It was right. Weird.
Although Jesus goes blue like that.
Yeah.
But so I was like, yeah, of course I'm going to take class. Yeah, I've been doing it for 8 years. I don't care. This is right. What I want to do. So here now I've been doing ASCAT for 20-something years.
Yes.
You know?
And you have to be willing to be open to these things, especially if something new is coming in and you want to be a part of it. Mm-hmm. You have to essentially reinvent the wheel or reintroduce yourself. And if you're good at what the other thing that you do, you may be able to advance quicker, but you have to start at the bottom, unfortunately. Right. Like when I tell comics who moved to Los Angeles this, they're all like, well, I'm not going to open mics. And I was like, okay, first of all, Hot Tub isn't an open mic. And they're like, yeah, but that doesn't pay. And I was like, Hot Tub actually pays $20. Anyway, so, but they're like, they don't want to start over. And I was like, well, no one knows that you're a big fucking deal in Indianapolis.
It was something I had no idea about when I moved here from New York. I thought I was doing very well in my career. I had I had just been on Conan. I had been on Comedy Central.
Yep.
None of that meant shit when I moved here.
None of it means anything. There's this town, Los Angeles itself, is full of so many talented people mm-hmm. that will never be famous or even never be successful. They will be successful in other things. They will invent dog psychicry.
Right.
And then all of a sudden they will own a house in Malibu because they are like, they're selling the tin pans for the gold mine, right? Mm-hmm. They're selling the equipment, but they wanted to be, and they're like, I one time did a corporate downtown at a club at Christmas that you were not allowed to use your cell phone in the lobby. Anyway, it was all very weird. Mm-hmm. And the people that I was performing for, they made nuts and bolts. They literally were people who made nuts and
they
bolts.
They were very nuts and bolts.
They were nuts and bolts people. But it was Christmas, and there was a quartet, a cappella quartet in the foyer who were singing Christmas carols dressed mm-hmm. in Victorian outfits. And they were amazing.
Christmas is all about Victorian.
It's for some reason, when London was unbreathable,
yeah.
Huge deal for mm-hmm. The Dickens people.
Right after the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. And but these singers were so amazing that I was like, who are you?
Yeah.
And they're like, we're singers.
And we work 1 month a year.
We work 1 month a year. And then the rest of it, we're just in the background over at the Pantages. Right. And but there's so much talent here that you literally have to admit that you're starting over to some extent.
It took me several years of living here
to come to
that realization of like, no, nobody gives a shit who you are.
It's okay.
You
know? And it's okay.
Yeah.
Just be as talented as you are and live in hope.
Don't you get that I was on fucking Conan? You know what I mean? Like
I do.
Now, and you know who doesn't even know that I was on Conan? Conan doesn't even know.
Conan has no memory of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It's. Did you read Tina Fey's book?
No.
Bossy Pants?
No.
Because there's a great line about stand-up, about improv in there, where she said, improv, people say that improv is like a cult. And she said, fine. What has your cult done for you? She's like, I'll tell you what it did for me. It gave me the best friends I've ever had.
Uh-huh.
I met my husband there.
Yeah.
It gave me a sense of self-esteem. It gave me a reason to live in some cases.
Uh-huh.
And it was such a beautiful like paragraph of just, she's like, okay, it's a cult.
Yeah.
But I'm not hurting anybody. And I got a family out of it. Right. You know, do you feel that kind of to some extent?
I mean, yeah, the people that I am, that I have been closest to as an adult are certainly the people that I have improvised with.
Yeah.
To me, improv is a little weird only because it's like you're in college, but it just goes on forever, you know?
Yes. Sometimes when I go to a college town, I think, God, I want to go back to college because I want to sit in a coffee shop and talk about the big issues.
Right.
And then I remember that I do stand-up, and I'm like, no, that's what I do. I go to a coffee shop and talk about, well,
nobody talks back, hopefully.
But, yeah, it's I think that, because I know in stand-up right now that there's an amazing upswell of talent that I think that you might be missing by not seeing a lot of the new improvers. Because what I initially noticed was about 15 or 16 years ago in stand-up that there was all of the new youth was really good looking. And I was like, because when I started doing stand-up, it was only the insane and the unattractive.
Yeah.
And it turns out because of psych meds, all of these children were nuts, but they also had really good dental. Mm-hmm. So they are some of the best looking crazy people I've ever met in my life. And so there was this influx of relatively good looking, very, very interesting stand-up comics that started out in like 2000 and 2004.
Right.
And they're, you know, sort of, I guess I would go, who am I thinking? I'm thinking of like Kinane, you know. And
so good looking, that Kinane. What a handsome gent.
Zach Galifianakis. That guy shaves his, I remember when he first grew that beard, I was like, what are you doing?
Uh-huh.
You're hiding the good looks. And he's like, the good looks are distracting. I hate them. He actually said that to me one night. Uh-huh. And because I inappropriately said that he was better looking without the beard. And he didn't care because it's his face. But it was, you know, it was like Zach Galifianakis and this type of thing, who's probably 15 years younger than I am or 10 years younger than I am.
I would say less. But
you think less?
We can figure that out.
Who
later.
Knows? Yeah, but let there be some math, you guys. Yeah. And I do love watching. I hate watching shitty stand-up comedy, but I do like. I don't mind. Like you, I could get bitter about Jenna Friedman, right? I don't know if you know her.
I do.
Yeah, she is an amazingly fearless, incredibly smart stand-up comic.
Mm-hmm.
And the stuff that she does politically and just weird, like some of the weird stuff, is a joy for me to watch.
Mm-hmm.
But I could be bitter about it because I'm like, no, I'm super smart too, but I'm not, I don't, turns out I'm not 28 right. years old and a thin blonde lady. but it's not.
She is the same age as Zach Galifianakis.
Weirdly enough, they're all in their early 60s, you guys. So I think that it's just to bitterness, though, and to appreciating the next generation.
Well, here's my thing about improv is just the feeling I have from being around the theater and seeing people and even some of the people I've performed with and whatever who are much, much younger than I am at this point. When I started, it was because this was a thing I wanted to do. And I feel like with a lot of people now, it's like, this is a thing I want to use to get something else.
Right.
Which is a different approach.
That is a different approach. Some people.
And when I started at UCB.
Yep.
It was like the island of misfit toys. It was like just everybody was a train with square wheels.
Right, you know? Slightly broken.
And now that's not the case at all. Now, like you said, a lot of them are good looking. They're actors. They're whatever.
Yep.
That doesn't mean they're not good improvisers, but it is a means to an end. It's
right, they're trying
exposure.
To get in front of casting directors and these people.
And that was just not the thing when I was doing it.
Right, and there was a and that it still happens in stand-up, right? Where people do stand-up to get in front of managers and casting agents and stuff like that. But they also and those people I think will always be there. But there are the people who fall in love with it.
Right.
You know, who you're like, oh, this is something I'm doing for something. And then all of a sudden, that is what they are.
Right.
And that I love meeting somebody who thinks that they're doing it because it's a shrewd business decision, which you always wonder why are you doing? You're doing stand-up as a shrewd, don't, that's a terrible choice.
Yeah.
And then they fall in love with it.
Mm.
And you're like, yeah, the first one's free, buddy. And now it's a potato knish that's a Welcome Back Connor reference. Hey, Sean Conroy, it's been an hour.
Mm. I'm sorry about that.
Because it just goes by.
Yeah.
Gotta have you back.
This reminds me of when I was in jail. It was like, you know, it was over so quickly.
So quickly. You guys, Rangers, we've been talking with Sean Conroy. It's S-E-A-N-C-O-N-R-O-Y.
Not W.
Not W. And you have a new podcast called Sean Conroy Gets Happier.
Correct.
And that will be available wherever you listen to casts, as you can imagine.
Everywhere, yeah.
Absolutely everywhere.
It's on the All Things Comedy Network.
And if you tick that box, they'll forward it to YouTube. So if people only can listen to a thing, because The Dork Forest is available on YouTube.
Oh, really?
Yeah, super fun.
And we have actually a new, we're going to have our own YouTube channel with this thing, too. The Sean, you know, youtube.com/... Sean Conroy Gets Happier.
Then that's where you should send those files, because then it'll all be in one place. Uh-huh. It'll be beautiful. So thank you so much for doing the show.
Thank you for having me. This was great.
And everyone follow Sean.
Or at least I enjoyed it. I shouldn't make any value judgments on the quality of the show itself. But Jackie, I had a great time.
Jackie at JackieKasia.com to let me know, you guys. I had a really good time. And Rangers, you know the rules out there. Take care of each other.
My hat, my hat, my hat. They're dancing around my hat, my hat, my hat, my hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh, my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?